The Great Chapter, translated by Bhikkhu Sujato. Sectarian Tenets. Mendicants, these three sectarian tenets, as pursued, pressed, and grilled by the astute, when taken to their conclusion, end with inaction. What three? There are some ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view. Everything this individual experiences, pleasurable, painful, or neutral, is because of past deeds. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view. Everything this individual experiences, pleasurable, painful, or neutral, is because of the Lord God's creation. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view. Everything this individual experiences, pleasurable, painful, or neutral, has no cause or reason. Regarding this, I went up to the ascetics and Brahmins, whose view is that everything that is experienced is because of past deeds, and I said to them, "Is it really true that this is the Venerable's view?" And they answered, "Yes." I said to them, "In that case, you might kill living creatures, steal, be unchaste, use speech that's false, divisive, harsh, or nonsensical, be covetous, malicious, or have wrong view, all because of past deeds." Those who believe that past deeds are the most important thing have no enthusiasm or effort, no idea that there are things that should and should not be done, since they don't acknowledge as a genuine fact that there are things that should and should not be done, they're unmindful and careless, and can't rightly be called ascetics. This is my first legitimate refutation of the ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view. Regarding this, I went up to the ascetics and Brahmins, whose view is that everything that is experienced is because of the Lord God's creation, and I said to them, "Is it really true that this is the Venerable's view?" And they answered, "Yes." I said to them, "In that case, you might kill living creatures, steal, be unchaste, use speech that's false, divisive, harsh or nonsensical, be covetous, malicious, or have wrong view, all because of the Lord God's creation." Those who believe that the Lord God's creative power is the most important thing have no enthusiasm, no effort, no idea that there are things that should and should not be done, since they don't acknowledge as a genuine fact that there are things that should and should not be done, they're unmindful and careless, and can't rightly be called ascetics. This is my second legitimate refutation of the ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view. Regarding this, I went up to the ascetics and Brahmins whose view is that everything that is experienced has no cause or reason, and I said to them, "Is it really true that this is the Venerable's view?" And they answered, "Yes." I said to them, "In that case, you might kill living creatures, steal, be unchaste, use speech that's false, divisive, harsh or nonsensical, be covetous, malicious, or have wrong view, all without cause or reason." Those who believe that the absence of cause or reason is the most important thing have no enthusiasm, no effort, no idea that there are things that should and should not be done. Since they don't acknowledge as a genuine fact that there are things that should and should not be done, they're unmindful and careless, and can't rightly be called ascetics. This is my third legitimate refutation of the ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view. These are the three sectarian tenets, as pursued, pressed, and grilled by the astute, which, when taken to their conclusion, end with inaction. But the Dhamma that I've taught is irrefutable, uncorrupted, beyond reproach, and not scorned by sensible ascetics and Brahmins. What is the Dhamma that I've taught? These are the six elements. This is the Dhamma I've taught. These are the six fields of contact. This is the Dhamma I've taught. These are the 18 mental preoccupations. This is the Dhamma I've taught. These are the four noble truths. This is the Dhamma I've taught that is irrefutable, uncorrupted, beyond reproach, and is not scorned by sensible ascetics and Brahmins. These are the six elements. This is the Dhamma I've taught. That's what I said, but why did I say it? There are these six elements, the elements of earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. These are the six elements. This is the Dhamma I've taught. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. These are the six fields of contact. This is the Dhamma I've taught. That's what I said, but why did I say it? There are these six fields of contact: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind contact. These are the six fields of contact. This is the Dhamma I've taught. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. These are the 18 mental preoccupations. This is the Dhamma I've taught. This is what I said, but why did I say it? Seeing a sight with the eye, one is preoccupied with a sight that's a basis for happiness or sadness or equanimity. Hearing a sound with the ear, one is preoccupied with a sound that's a basis for happiness or sadness or equanimity. Smelling an odour with the nose, one is preoccupied with a smell that's a basis for happiness or sadness or equanimity. Tasting a flavour with the tongue, one is preoccupied with a taste that's a basis for happiness or sadness or equanimity. Feeling a touch with the body, one is preoccupied with a touch that's a basis for happiness or sadness or equanimity. Becoming conscious of a thought with the mind, one is preoccupied with a thought that's a basis for happiness or sadness or equanimity. These are the 18 mental preoccupations. This is the Dhamma I've taught. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. These are the Four Noble Truths. This is the Dhamma I've taught. That's what I said, but why did I say it? Supported by the six elements, an embryo is conceived. When it is conceived, there are name and form. Name and form are conditions for the six sense fields. The six sense fields are conditions for contact. Contact is a condition for feeling. It's for one who feels that I declare, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. And what is the noble truth of suffering? Rebirth is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress are suffering. Association with the disliked is suffering. Separation from the liked is suffering. Not getting what you wish for is suffering. In brief, the five grasping aggregates are suffering. This is called the noble truth of suffering. And what is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? Ignorance is a condition for choices. Choices are a condition for consciousness. Consciousness is a condition for name and form. Name and form are conditions for the six sense fields. The six sense fields are conditions for contact. Contact is a condition for feeling. Feeling is a condition for craving. Craving is a condition for grasping. Grasping is a condition for continued existence. Continued existence is a condition for rebirth. Rebirth is a condition for old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress to come to be. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. This is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. And what is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? When ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, choices cease. When choices cease, consciousness ceases. When consciousness ceases, name and form cease. When name and form cease, the six sense fields cease. When the six sense fields cease, contact ceases. When contact ceases, feeling ceases. When feeling ceases, craving ceases. When craving ceases, grasping ceases. When grasping ceases, continued existence ceases. When continued existence ceases, rebirth ceases. When rebirth ceases, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress cease. That is how this entire mass of suffering ceases. This is called the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And what is the noble truth of the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering? It is simply this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right immersion. This is called the noble truth of the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. These are the four noble truths. This is the Dhamma I've taught that is irrefutable, uncorrupted, beyond reproach, and is not scorned by sensible ascetics and Brahmins. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. Perils. Mendicants. An uneducated, ordinary person speaks of three perils that tear mothers and children apart. What three? There comes a time when a great fire flares up, and it burns villages, towns, and cities. When this happens, a mother can't find her child, and a child can't find their mother. This is the first peril that tears mothers and children apart. Furthermore, there comes a time when a great storm gathers, and it unleashes a mighty flood that sweeps away villages, towns, and cities. When this happens, a mother can't find her child, and a child can't find their mother. This is the second peril that tears mothers and children apart. Furthermore, there comes a time of peril from wild savages, and the country folk mount their vehicles and flee everywhere. When this happens, a mother can't find her child, and a child can't find their mother. This is the third peril that tears mothers and children apart. These are the three perils an uneducated, ordinary person speaks of that tear mothers and children apart. Mendicants. An uneducated, ordinary person speaks of three perils that don't tear mothers and children apart. What three? There comes a time when a great fire flares up and it burns villages, towns, and cities. When this happens, sometimes a mother can find her child, and a child can find their mother. This is the first peril that doesn't tear mothers and children apart. Furthermore, there comes a time when a great storm gathers, and it unleashes a mighty flood that sweeps away villages, towns, and cities. When this happens, sometimes a mother can find her child, and a child can find their mother. This is the second peril that doesn't tear mothers and children apart. Furthermore, there comes a time of peril from wild savages, and the country folk mount their vehicles and flee everywhere. When this happens, sometimes a mother can find her child, and a child can find their mother. This is the third peril that doesn't tear mothers and children apart. These are the three perils an uneducated, ordinary person speaks of that don't tear mothers and children apart. There are three perils that tear mothers and children apart. What three? The perils of old age, sickness, and death. When a child is growing old, a mother doesn't get her wish. Let me grow old, may my child not grow old. When a mother is growing old, a child doesn't get their wish. Let me grow old, may my mother not grow old. When a child is sick, a mother doesn't get her wish. Let me be sick, may my child not be sick. When a mother is sick, a child doesn't get their wish. Let me be sick, may my mother not be sick. When a child is dying, a mother doesn't get her wish. Let me die, may my child not die. When a mother is dying, a child doesn't get their wish. Let me die, may my mother not die. These are the three perils that tear mothers and children apart. There is a path and a practice that leads to giving up and going beyond the three perils that don't tear mothers and children apart, and the three perils that do tear mothers and children apart. What is that path and practice? It is simply this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right immersion. This is the path, this is the practice that leads to giving up and going beyond the three perils that don't tear mothers and children apart, and the three perils that do tear mothers and children apart. at Wainyagupura. At one time, the Buddha was wandering in the land of the Kosalans, together with a large sangha of mendicants, when he arrived at a village of the Kosalan Brahmins named Wainyagupura. The Brahmins and householders of Wainyagupura heard, "It seems the ascetic Gotama, a Sakyan gone forth from a Sakyan family, has arrived at Wainyagupura. He has this good reputation. That Blessed One is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. He has realized with his own insight this world, with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, gods and humans, and he makes it known to others. He teaches Dhamma that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, meaningful and well phrased, and he reveals a spiritual practice that's entirely full and pure. It's good to see such perfected ones." Then the Brahmins and householders of Wainyagupura went up to the Buddha. Before sitting down to one side, some bowed, some exchanged greetings and polite conversation, some held up their joined palms toward the Buddha, some announced their name and clan, while some kept silent. Then the Brahmin Vachagotta of Wainyagupura said to the Buddha, "It's incredible, Master Gotama. It's amazing how your faculties are so very clear, and the complexion of your skin is pure and bright. It's like a golden brown jujube in the autumn, or a palm fruit freshly plucked from the stalk, or a pendant of river gold fashioned by a deft smith, well wrought in the forge, and placed on a cream rug where it shines and glows and radiates. In the same way, your faculties are so very clear, and the complexion of your skin is pure and bright. Surely Master Gotama gets when he wants, without trouble or difficulty, various kinds of high and luxurious bedding, such as sofas, couches, woollen covers, shag-piled, colourful, white, embroidered with flowers, quilted, embroidered with animals, double or single-fringed, and silk covers, studded with gems, as well as silken sheets, woven carpets, rugs for elephants, horses or chariots, antelope hide rugs, and spreads of fine deer hide, with a canopy above and red cushions at both ends." Brahmin: "These various kinds of high and luxurious bedding are hard for renunciates to find, and even if they do get them, they're not allowed. There are, Brahmin, these three high and luxurious beds that I get these days when I want, without trouble or difficulty." "What three?" "The high and luxurious beds of the gods, of Brahma, and of the noble ones. These are the three high and luxurious beds that I get these days when I want, without trouble or difficulty." "But what, Master Gotama, is the high and luxurious bed of the gods?" Brahmin: "When I am living supported by a village or town, I robe up in the morning and, taking my bowl and robe, enter the town or village for alms. After the meal, on my return from alms round, I enter a wood. I gather up some grass or leaves into a pile and sit down cross-legged with my body straight and establish mindfulness right there. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, I enter and remain in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, while placing the mind and keeping it connected. As the placing of the mind and keeping it connected are stilled, I enter and remain in the second absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of immersion, with internal clarity and confidence, and unified mind, without placing the mind and keeping it connected. And with a fading away of rapture, I enter and remain in the third absorption, where I meditate with equanimity, mindful and aware, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones declare, 'Equanimous and mindful, one meditates in bliss.' With the giving up of pleasure and pain, and the ending of former happiness and sadness, I enter and remain in the fourth absorption, without pleasure or pain, with pure equanimity and mindfulness. When I'm practicing like this, if I walk, at that time I walk like the gods. When I'm practicing like this, if I stand, at that time I stand like the gods. When I'm practicing like this, if I sit, at that time I sit like the gods. When I'm practicing like this, if I lie down, at that time I lie down like the gods. This is the high and luxurious bed of the gods that I get these days when I want, without trouble or difficulty. It's incredible, Master Gotama. It's amazing. Who but Master Gotama could get such a high and luxurious bed of the gods when he wants, without trouble or difficulty? But what, Master Gotama, is the high and luxurious bed of Brahma? Brahmin, when I'm living supported by a village or town, I robe up in the morning and, taking my bowl and robe, enter the town or village for alms. After the meal, on my return from alms round, I enter a wood. I gather up some grass or leaves into a pile and sit down cross-legged with my body straight and establish mindfulness right there. I meditate, spreading a heartful of love to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way, above, below, across, everywhere, all around, I spread a heartful of love to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. I meditate, spreading a heartful of compassion to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way, above, below, across, everywhere, all around, I spread a heartful of compassion to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. I meditate, spreading a heartful of rejoicing to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way, above, below, across, everywhere, all around, I spread a heartful of rejoicing to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. I meditate, spreading a heartful of equanimity to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way, above, below, across, everywhere, all around, I spread a heartful of equanimity to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. When I'm practicing like this, if I walk, at that time I walk like Brahma. I stand like Brahma. I sit like Brahma. When I'm practicing like this, if I lie down at that time, I lie down like Brahma. This is the high and luxurious bed of Brahma that I get these days when I want, without trouble or difficulty. It's incredible, Master Gotama. It's amazing. Who but Master Gotama could get such a high and luxurious bed of Brahma when he wants, without trouble or difficulty? But what, Master Gotama, is the high and luxurious bed of the noble ones? Brahmin, when I'm living supported by a village or town, I robe up in the morning and, taking my bowl and robe, enter the town or village for alms. After the meal, on my return from alms round, I enter a wood, I gather up some grass or leaves into a pile, and sit down cross-legged, with my body straight, and establish mindfulness right there. I know this. I've given up greed, hate, and delusion, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, obliterated them, so they're unable to arise in the future. When I'm practicing like this, if I walk, at that time, I walk like the noble ones. I stand like the noble ones. I sit like the noble ones. When I'm practicing like this, if I lie down, at that time, I lie down like the noble ones. This is the high and luxurious bed of the noble ones that I get these days when I want, without trouble or difficulty. It's incredible, Master Gotama. It's amazing. Who but Master Gotama could get such a high and luxurious bed of the noble ones when he wants, without trouble or difficulty? Excellent, Master Gotama, excellent. As if he were writing the overturned, or revealing the hidden, or pointing out the path to the lost, or lighting a lamp in the dark so people with good eyes can see what's there. Master Gotama has made the teaching clear in many ways. We go for refuge to Master Gotama, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may Master Gotama remember us as lay followers who have gone for refuge for life. With Sarabha. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was staying near Rajagaha on the Vulture's Peak Mountain. Now at that time, a wanderer called Sarabha had recently left this teaching and training. He was telling a crowd in Rajagaha, I learned the teaching of the ascetics who follow the Sakyan, then I left their teaching and training. Then several mendicants robed up in the morning and, taking their bowls and robes, entered Rajagaha for alms. They heard what Sarabha was saying. Then after the meal, when they returned from alms round, they went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side and said to him, The wanderer called Sarabha has recently left this teaching and training. He was telling a crowd in Rajagaha, I learned the teaching of the ascetics who follow the Sakyan, then I left their teaching and training. Sir, please go to the wanderer's monastery on the banks of the Sapini River to see Sarabha, the wanderer, out of compassion. The Buddha consented in silence. Then, in the late afternoon, the Buddha came out of retreat and went to the wanderer's monastery on the banks of the Sapini River to visit Sarabha, the wanderer. He sat on the seat spread out and said to the wanderer, Sarabha, Is it really true, Sarabha, that you've been saying, I learned the teaching of the ascetics who follow the Sakyan, then I left their teaching and training. When he said this, Sarabha kept silent. For a second time the Buddha said to Sarabha, Tell me, Sarabha, what exactly have you learned of the teachings of the ascetics who follow the Sakyan? If you've not learned it fully, I'll fill you in. But if you have learned it fully, I'll agree. For a second time Sarabha kept silent. For a third time the Buddha said to Sarabha, Sarabha, the teachings of the ascetics who follow the Sakyan are clear to me. What exactly have you learned of the teachings of the ascetics who follow the Sakyan? If you've not learned it fully, I'll fill you in. But if you have learned it fully, I'll agree. For a third time Sarabha kept silent. Then those wanderers said to Sarabha, The ascetic Gotama has offered to tell you anything you ask for. Speak, Reverend Sarabha. What exactly have you learned of the teachings of the ascetics who follow the Sakyan? If you've not learned it fully, he'll fill you in. But if you have learned it fully, he'll agree. When this was said, Sarabha sat silent, embarrassed, shoulders drooping, downcast, depressed, with nothing to say. Knowing this, the Buddha said to the wanderers, Wanderers, someone might say to me, You claim to be a fully awakened Buddha, but regarding these things you're not fully awakened. Then I'd carefully pursue, press, and grill them on that point. When grilled by me, they would, without a doubt, fall into one of these three categories. They'd dodge the issue, distracting the discussion with irrelevant points. They'd display annoyance, hate, or bitterness, or they'd sit silent, embarrassed, shoulders drooping, downcast, depressed, with nothing to say, like Sarabha. Wanderers, someone might say to me, You claim to have ended all defilements, but you still have these defilements. Then I'd carefully pursue, press, and grill them on that point. When grilled by me, they would, without a doubt, fall into one of these three categories. They'd dodge the issue, distracting the discussion with irrelevant points. They'd display annoyance, hate, and bitterness. Or they'd sit silent, embarrassed, shoulders drooping, downcast, depressed, with nothing to say, like Sarabha. Wanderers, someone might say to me, Your teaching does not lead someone who practices it to the goal of the complete ending of suffering. Then I'd carefully pursue, press, and grill them on that point. When grilled by me, they would, without a doubt, fall into one of these three categories. They'd dodge the issue, distracting the discussion with irrelevant points. They'd display annoyance, hate, and bitterness. Or they'd sit silent, embarrassed, shoulders drooping, downcast, depressed, with nothing to say, like Sarabha. Then the Buddha, having roared his lion's roar 3 times in the wanderer's monastery on the bank of the Sapini River, rose into the sky and flew away. Soon after the Buddha left, those wanderers gave Sarabha a comprehensive tongue-lashing. "Reverend Sarabha, you're just like an old jackal in the formidable wilderness who thinks, 'I'll roar a lion's roar.' But they still only manage to squeal and yelp like a jackal. In the same way, when the ascetic Gotama wasn't here, you said, 'I'll roar a lion's roar,' but you only managed to squeal and yelp like a jackal. You're just like a golden oriole who thinks, 'I'll cry like a cuckoo,' but they still only manage to cry like a golden oriole. In the same way, when the ascetic Gotama wasn't here, you said, 'I'll cry like a cuckoo,' but you still only managed to cry like a golden oriole. You're just like a bull that thinks to bellow only when the cow stall is empty. In the same way, you only thought to bellow when the ascetic Gotama wasn't here." That's how those wanderers gave Sarabha a comprehensive tongue-lashing. With the Kalamas of Kesamutta. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was wandering in the land of the Kosalans, together with a large sangha of mendicants, when he arrived at a town of the Kalamas named Kesamutta. The Kalamas of Kesamutta heard, "It seems the ascetic Gotama, a Sakyan gone forth from a Sakyan family, has arrived at Kesamutta. He has this good reputation. That blessed one is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha. It's good to see such perfected ones." Then the Kalamas went up to the Buddha. Before sitting down to one side, some bowed, some exchanged greetings and polite conversation, some held up their joined palms toward the Buddha, some announced their name and clan, while some kept silent. Seated to one side, the Kalamas said to the Buddha, "There are, sir, some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesamutta. They explain and promote only their own doctrine, while they attack, badmouth, disparage, and smear the doctrines of others. Then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesamutta. They too explain and promote only their own doctrine, while they attack, badmouth, disparage, and smear the doctrines of others. So, sir, we're doubting and uncertain. I wonder who of these respected ascetics and Brahmins speaks the truth and who speaks falsehood." "It is enough, Kalamas, for you to be doubting and uncertain. Doubt has come up in you about an uncertain matter. Please, Kalamas, don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think, 'The ascetic is our respected teacher.' But when you know for yourselves, these things are unskillful, blameworthy, criticized by sensible people, and when you undertake them, they lead to harm and suffering, then you should give them up. What do you think, Kalamas? Does greed come up in a person for their welfare or harm?"
"Harm, sir."
"A greedy individual, overcome by greed, kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering?"
"Yes, sir."
"What do you think, Kalamas? Does hate come up in a person for their welfare or harm?"
"Harm, sir."
"A hateful individual, overcome by hate, kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering?"
"Yes, sir."
"What do you think, Kalamas? Does delusion come up in a person for their welfare or harm?"
"Harm, sir."
"A deluded individual, overcome by delusion, kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies and encourages others to do the same, is that for their lasting harm and suffering?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Karlamas? Are these things skilful or unskilful?
Unskilful, sir.
Blameworthy or blameless?
Blameworthy, sir.
Criticised or praised by sensible people?
Criticised by sensible people, sir.
When you undertake them, do they lead to harm and suffering or not? Or how do you see this?
When you undertake them, they lead to harm and suffering. That's how we see it.
So, Karlamas, when I said, please don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think, the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves, these things are unskilful, blameworthy, criticised by sensible people, and when you undertake them, they lead to harm and suffering, then you should give them up. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. Please, Karlamas, don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves these things are skilful, blameless, praised by sensible people, and when you undertake them they lead to welfare and happiness, then you should acquire them and keep them. What do you think, Karlamas? Does contentment come up in a person for their welfare or harm?
Welfare, sir.
An individual who is content, not overcome by greed, doesn't kill living creatures, steal, commit adultery, lie, or encourage others to do the same, is that for their lasting welfare and happiness?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Karlamas? Does love come up in a person for their welfare or harm? Does understanding come up in a person for their welfare or harm? Is that for their lasting welfare and happiness?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Karlamas? Are these things skilful or unskilful?
Skilful, sir.
Blameworthy or blameless?
Blameless, sir.
Criticised or praised by sensible people?
Praised by sensible people, sir.
When you undertake them, do they lead to welfare and happiness or not? Or how do you see this?
When you undertake them, they lead to welfare and happiness. That's how we see it.
So, Karlamas, when I said, please don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves these things are skilful, blameless, praised by sensible people, and when you undertake them, they lead to welfare and happiness, then you should acquire them and keep them. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. Then that noble disciple is rid of desire, rid of ill will, unconfused, aware, and mindful. They meditate, spreading a heart full of love to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way above, below, across, everywhere, all around, they spread a heart full of love to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. They meditate, spreading a heart full of compassion to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way above, below, across, everywhere, all around, they spread a heart full of compassion to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. They meditate, spreading a heart full of rejoicing to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way above, below,
across, everywhere, all around. They spread a heart full of rejoicing to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. They meditate spreading a heart full of equanimity to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way above, below, across, everywhere, all around, they spread a heart full of equanimity to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. When that noble disciple has a mind that's free of enmity and ill will, uncorrupted and purified, they've won four consolations in the present life. If it turns out there is another world, and good and bad deeds have a result, then, when the body breaks up after death, I'll be reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm. This is the first consolation they've won. If it turns out there is no other world, and good and bad deeds don't have a result, then, in the present life, I'll keep myself free of enmity and ill will, untroubled and happy. This is the second consolation they've won. If it turns out that bad things happen to people who do bad things, then since I have no bad intentions, and since I'm not doing anything bad, how can suffering touch me? This is the third consolation they've won. If it turns out that bad things don't happen to people who do bad things, then I still see myself pure on both sides. This is the fourth consolation they've won. When that noble disciple has a mind that's free of enmity and ill will, undefiled and purified, they've won these four consolations in the present life. That's so true, Blessed One. That's so true, Holy One. When that noble disciple has a mind that's free of enmity and ill will, undefiled and purified, they've won these four consolations in the present life. Excellent, sir, excellent. We go for refuge to Master Gotama, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may the Buddha remember us as lay followers who have gone for refuge for life. With Salha and his friend. So I have heard. Now at that time, Venerable Nandaka was staying near Sarvati in the Eastern Monastery, the stilt longhouse of Megara's mother. Then Salha, Megara's grandson, and Rohana, Pekuniya's grandson, went up to the Venerable Nandaka, bowed and sat down to one side. Then Venerable Nandaka said to Salha, "Please, Salha and friend, don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves these things are unskillful, blameworthy, criticized by sensible people, and when you undertake them, they lead to harm and suffering, then you should give them up." What do you think, Salha? Is greed real?
Yes, sir.
Covetousness is what I mean by this. A person who is greedy and covetous kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies, and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Salha? Is hate real?
Yes, sir.
Malice is what I mean by this. A hateful and malicious person kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies, and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Salha? Is delusion real?
Yes, sir.
Ignorance is what I mean by this. A person who is deluded and ignorant kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies, and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Salha? Are these things skillful or unskillful?
Unskillful, sir.
Blameworthy or blameless?
Blameworthy, sir.
Criticized or praised by sensible people?
criticised by sensible people, sir.
When you undertake them, do they lead to harm and suffering or not? Or how do you see this?
When you undertake them, they lead to harm and suffering. That's how we see it.
So, Salha and friend, when I said, please don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves these things are unskillful, blameworthy, criticised by sensible people, and when you undertake them they lead to harm and suffering, then you should give them up. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. Please, Salha and friend, don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves these things are skillful, blameless, praised by sensible people, and when you undertake them they lead to welfare and happiness, then you should acquire them and keep them. What do you think? Is contentment real?
Yes, sir.
Satisfaction is what I mean by this. A person who is content and satisfied doesn't kill living creatures, steal, commit adultery, lie, or encourage others to do the same. Is that for their lasting welfare and happiness?
Yes, sir.
What do you think? Is love real?
Yes, sir.
Kindness is what I mean by this. A loving and kind-hearted person doesn't kill living creatures, steal, commit adultery, lie, or encourage others to do the same. Is that for their lasting welfare and happiness?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Salha? Is understanding real?
Yes, sir.
Knowledge is what I mean by this. A person who understands and knows doesn't kill living creatures, steal, commit adultery, lie, or encourage others to do the same. Is that for their lasting welfare and happiness?
Yes, sir.
What do you think, Salha? Are these things skillful or unskillful?
Skillful, sir.
Blameworthy or blameless?
Blameless, sir.
Criticised or praised by sensible people?
Praised by sensible people, sir.
When you undertake them, do they lead to welfare and happiness or not? Or how do you see this? When you undertake them, they lead to welfare and happiness. That's how we see it. So, Salha and friend, when I said, please don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned contemplation, don't go by the acceptance of a view after consideration, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves, these things are skillful, blameless, praised by sensible people, and when you undertake them, they lead to welfare and happiness, then you should acquire them and keep them. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. Then that noble disciple is rid of desire, rid of ill will, unconfused, aware and mindful. They meditate spreading a heart full of love, compassion, rejoicing, equanimity, to one direction, and to the second, and to the third, and to the fourth. In the same way above, below, across, everywhere, all around, they spread a heart full of equanimity to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. They understand, there is this, there is what is worse than this, there is what is better than this, and there is an escape beyond the scope of perception. Knowing and seeing like this, their mind is freed from the defilements of sensuality, desire to be reborn, and ignorance. When they're freed, they know they're freed. They understand, rebirth is ended, the spiritual journey has been completed, what had to be done has been done,
There is no return to any state of existence. They understand, formerly there was greed, which was unskillful. Now there is none, so that's skillful. Formerly there was hate, which was unskillful. Now there is none, so that's skillful. Formerly there was delusion, which was unskillful. Now there is none, so that's skillful. So they live without wishes in the present life, extinguished, cooled, experiencing bliss, having become holy in themselves.
Topics of discussion. There are, mendicants, these three topics of discussion.
What three?
You might discuss the past. That is how it was in the past.
You might discuss the future.
That is how it will be in the future.
Or you might discuss the present.
This is how it is at present.
You can know whether or not a person is competent to hold a discussion by seeing how they take part in a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if it needs to be answered definitively and they don't answer it definitively, or if it needs analysis and they answer without analysing it, or if it needs a counter-question and they answer without a counter-question, or if it should be set aside and they don't set it aside, then that person is not competent to hold a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if it needs to be answered definitively and they answer it definitively, or if it needs analysis and the answer after analysing it, or if it needs a counter-question and the answer with a counter-question, or if it should be set aside and they set it aside, then that person is competent to hold a discussion.
You can know whether or not a person is competent to hold a discussion by seeing how they take part in a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if they're not consistent about what their position is and what it isn't, about what they propose, about speaking from what they know, and about the appropriate procedure, then that person is not competent to hold a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if they are consistent about what their position is and what it isn't, about what they propose, about speaking from what they know, and about the appropriate procedure, then that person is competent to hold a discussion.
You can know whether or not a person is competent to hold a discussion by seeing how they take part in a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if they dodge the issue, distract the discussion with irrelevant points, or display annoyance, hate, and bitterness, then that person is not competent to hold a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if they don't dodge the issue, distract the discussion with irrelevant points, or display annoyance, hate, and bitterness, then that person is competent to hold a discussion.
You can know whether or not a person is competent to hold a discussion by seeing how they take part in a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if they intimidate, crush, mock, or seize on trivial mistakes, then that person is not competent to hold a discussion.
When a person is asked a question, if they don't intimidate, crush, mock, or seize on trivial mistakes, then that person is competent to hold a discussion.
You can know whether or not a person has what's required by seeing how they take part in a discussion.
If they lend an ear, they have what's required.
If they don't lend an ear, they don't have what's required.
Someone who has what's required directly knows one thing, completely understands one thing, gives up one thing, and realizes one thing. And then they experience complete freedom.
This is the purpose of discussion, consultation, the requirements, and listening well.
That is the liberation of the mind by not grasping.
Those who converse with hostility, too sure of themselves, arrogant, ignoble, attacking virtues, they look for flaws in each other.
They rejoice together when their opponent speaks poorly and makes a mistake, becoming confused and defeated.
But the noble ones don't discuss like this.
If an astute person wants to hold a discussion connected with the teaching and its meaning, the kind of discussion that noble ones hold, then that wise one should start the discussion knowing when the time is right, neither hostile nor arrogant, not overexcited, contemptuous or aggressive, or with a mind full of jealousy, they'd speak from what they rightly know. They agree with what was well spoken, without criticising what was poorly said. They'd not persist in finding faults, nor seize on trivial mistakes, neither intimidating nor crushing the other, nor would they speak with sly implications. Good people consult for the sake of knowledge and clarity. That's how the noble ones consult. This is a noble consultation. Knowing this, an intelligent person would consult without arrogance. Followers of other paths. Mendicants, if wanderers who follow other paths were to ask, "There are these three things, what three? Greed, hate, and delusion. These are the three things. What's the difference between them?" How would you answer them? Our teachings are rooted in the Buddha. He is our guide and our refuge. Sir, may the Buddha himself please clarify the meaning of this. The mendicants will listen and remember it. Well then, mendicants, listen and pay close attention. I will speak. Yes, sir, they replied. The Buddha said this. Mendicants, if wanderers who follow other paths were to ask, "There are these three things, what three? Greed, hate, and delusion. These are the three things. What's the difference between them?" You should answer them, "Greed, reverends, is mildly blameworthy, but slow to fade away. Hate is very blameworthy, but quick to fade away. Delusion is very blameworthy and slow to fade away." And if they ask, "What is the cause? What is the reason why greed arises, and once arisen it increases and grows?" you should say, "The beautiful feature of things. When you attend improperly to the beautiful feature of things, greed arises, and once arisen it increases and grows. This is the cause, this is the reason why greed arises, and once arisen it increases and grows." And if they ask, "What is the cause? What is the reason why hate arises, and once arisen it increases and grows?" you should say, "The feature of harshness. When you attend improperly to the feature of harshness, hate arises, and once arisen it increases and grows. This is the cause, this is the reason why hate arises, and once arisen it increases and grows." And if they ask, "What is the cause? What is the reason why delusion arises, and once arisen it increases and grows?" you should say, "Improper attention. When you attend improperly, delusion arises, and once arisen it increases and grows. This is the cause, this is the reason why delusion arises, and once arisen it increases and grows." And if they ask, "What is the cause? What is the reason why greed doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen it's given up?" you should say, "The ugly feature of things. When you attend properly on the ugly feature of things, greed doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up. This is the cause, this is the reason why greed doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up." And if they ask, "What is the cause? What is the reason why hate doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up?" you should say, "The heart's release by love. When you attend properly on the heart's release by love, hate doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up. This is the cause, this is the reason why hate doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up." And if they ask, "What is the cause? What is the reason why delusion doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up?" you should say, "Proper attention. When you attend properly, delusion doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up. This is the cause, this is the reason why delusion doesn't arise, or if it's already arisen, it's given up." Unskillful roots. Mendicants, there are these three unskillful roots. What three? Greed, hate, and delusion. Greed is a root of the unskillful. When a greedy person chooses to act by way of body, speech, or mind, that too is unskillful.
when a greedy person, overcome by greed, causes another to suffer under a false pretext, by execution or imprisonment, or confiscation, or condemnation, or banishment, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, that too is unskilful. And so these many bad, unskilful things are produced in them, born, sourced, originated, and conditioned by greed. Hate is a root of the unskilful. When a hateful person chooses to act by way of body, speech, or mind, that too is unskilful. When a hateful person, overcome by hate, causes another to suffer under a false pretext, by execution, or imprisonment, or confiscation, or condemnation, or banishment, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, that too is unskilful. And so these many bad, unskilful things are produced in them, born, sourced, originated, and conditioned by hate. Delusion is a root of the unskilful. When a deluded person chooses to act by way of body, speech, or mind, that too is unskilful. When a deluded person, overcome by delusion, causes another to suffer under a false pretext, by execution, or imprisonment, or confiscation, or condemnation, or banishment, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, that too is unskilful. And so these many bad, unskilful things are produced in them, born, sourced, originated, and conditioned by delusion. Such a person is said to have speech that's ill-timed, false, meaningless, not in line with the teaching and training. Why is this? This person causes another to suffer under a false pretext, by execution or imprisonment or confiscation or condemnation or banishment, thinking, I'm powerful, I want power. So when someone makes a valid criticism, they're scornful and admit nothing. When someone makes a baseless criticism, they make no effort to explain, this is why that's untrue, this is why that's false. That's why such a person is said to have speech that's ill-timed, false, meaningless, not in line with the teaching and training. Such a person, overcome with bad, unskillful qualities born of greed, hate, and delusion, suffers in the present life with anguish, distress, and fever. And when the body breaks up after death, they can expect to be reborn in a bad place. Suppose a sal, axlewood, or boxwood tree was choked and engulfed by 3 camel's foot creepers. It would fall to ruin and disaster. In the same way, such a person, overcome with bad, unskillful qualities born of greed, hate, and delusion, suffers in the present life with anguish, distress, and fever. And when the body breaks up after death, they can expect to be reborn in a bad place. These are the 3 unskillful roots. There are these 3 skillful roots. What 3? Contentment, love, and understanding. Contentment is a root of the skillful. When a contented person chooses to act by way of body, speech, or mind, that too is skillful. When a contented person, not overcome by greed, doesn't cause another to suffer under a false pretext, by execution, or imprisonment, or confiscation, or condemnation, or banishment, thinking, I'm powerful, I want power, that too is skillful. And so these many skillful things are produced in them, born, sourced, originated, and conditioned by contentment. Love is a root of the skillful. When a loving person chooses to act by way of body, speech, or mind, that too is skillful. When a loving person, not overcome by hate, doesn't cause another to suffer under a false pretext, by execution, or imprisonment, or confiscation, or condemnation, or banishment, thinking, I'm powerful, I want power, that too is skillful. And so these many skillful things are produced in them, born, sourced, originated, and conditioned by love. Understanding is a root of the skillful. When an understanding person chooses to act by way of body, speech, or mind, that too is skillful. When an understanding person, not overcome by delusion, doesn't cause another to suffer under a false pretext, by execution or imprisonment, or confiscation, or condemnation, or banishment, thinking, I'm powerful, I want power, that too is skillful. And so these many skillful things are produced in them, born, sourced, originated, and conditioned by understanding. Such a person is said to have speech that's well-timed, true, meaningful, in line with the teaching and training. Why is this? This person doesn't cause another to suffer under a false pretext by execution or imprisonment or confiscation or condemnation or banishment, thinking, I'm powerful, I want power. So when someone makes a valid criticism, they admit it and aren't scornful. When someone makes a baseless criticism, they make an effort to explain. This is why that's untrue. This is why that's false. That's why such a person is said to have speech that's well-timed, true, meaningful, in line with the teaching and training. For such a person, bad, unskillful qualities born of greed, hate, and delusion are cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, and unable to arise in the future. In the present life they're happy, free of anguish, distress, and fever, and they're also extinguished in the present life. Suppose a sal, axlewood, or boxwood tree was choked and engulfed by three camel's foot creepers. Then along comes a person with a spade and basket. They'd cut the creeper out by the roots, dig them up, and pull them out, down to the fibres and stems. Then they'd split the creeper apart, cut up the parts, and chop it into splinters. They'd dry the splinters in the wind and sun, burn them with fire, and reduce them to ashes. Then they'd sweep away the ashes in a strong wind, or float them away down a swift stream. In the same way, for such a person, bad, unskillful qualities born of greed, hate, and delusion are cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, and unable to arise in the future. In the present life, they're happy, free of anguish, distress, and fever, and they're also extinguished in the present life. These are the three skillful roots. Sabbath. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in the eastern monastery, the stilt longhouse of Migara's mother. Then Visakha, Migara's mother, went up to the Buddha, bowed, and sat down to one side. The Buddha said to her, "So, Visakha, where are you coming from in the middle of the day?" "Today, sir, I'm observing the Sabbath." "There are, Visakha, these three Sabbaths." "What three?" "The Sabbath of the cowherds, the Sabbath of the Jains, and the Sabbath of the noble ones." "And what is the Sabbath of the cowherds?" "It's just like a cowherd who, in the late afternoon, takes the cows back to their owners. They reflect, 'Today the cows grazed in this place and that, and they drank in this place and that. Tomorrow the cows will graze in this place and that, and drink in this place and that.' In the same way, someone keeping the Sabbath reflects, 'Today I ate this and that, and had a meal of this and that. Tomorrow I'll eat this and that, and have a meal of this and that.' And so they spend their day with a mind full of covetousness. That's the Sabbath of the cowherds. When the cowherd's Sabbath is observed like this, it's not very fruitful or beneficial or splendid or bountiful. And what is the Sabbath of the Jains? There's a kind of ascetic belonging to a group called the Jains. They encourage their disciples, 'Please, good people, don't hurt any living creatures more than 100 leagues away to the east. Don't hurt any living creatures more than 100 leagues away to the west. Don't hurt any living creatures more than 100 leagues away to the north. Don't hurt any living creatures more than 100 leagues away to the south.' So they encourage kindness and compassion for some creatures and not others. On the Sabbath they encourage their disciples, 'Please, good people, take off all your clothes and say, I don't belong to anyone anywhere, and nothing belongs to me anywhere.' But their mother and father still know, 'This is our child,' and they know, 'This is my mother and father.' Partner and child still know, this is our supporter, and they know this is my partner and child. Bondservants, workers and staff still know this is our master, and they know these are my bondservants, workers and staff. So at a time when they should be encouraged to speak the truth, the Janes encouraged them to lie. This, I say, is lying. When the night has passed, they use their possessions once more, though they've not been given back to them. This, I say, is stealing. That's the Sabbath of the Janes. When the Jain Sabbath is observed like this, it's not very fruitful, or beneficial, or splendid, or bountiful. And what is the Sabbath of the noble ones? A corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the realized one, that blessed one is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. As they recollect the realized one, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. It's just like cleaning a dirty head by applying effort. And how is a dirty head cleaned by applying effort? With cleansing paste, clay, and water, and by applying the appropriate effort. In the same way, a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the realized one, that blessed one is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. As they recollect the realized one, their mind becomes clear, joy arises and mental corruptions are given up. This is called a noble disciple who observes the Sabbath of Brahma, living together with Brahma. And because they think of Brahma, their mind becomes clear, joy arises and mental corruptions are given up. That's how a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. A corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the teaching. The teaching is well explained by the Buddha, visible in his very life, immediately effective, inviting inspection, relevant, so that sensible people can know it for themselves. And as they recollect the teaching, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. It's just like cleaning a dirty body by applying effort. And how is a dirty body cleaned by applying effort? With pastes of powdered shells and herbs, water, and by applying the appropriate effort. That's how a dirty body is cleaned by applying effort. In the same way, a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the teaching is well explained by the Buddha, visible in this very life, immediately effective, inviting inspection, relevant, so that sensible people can know it for themselves. As they recollect the teaching, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. This is called a noble disciple who observes the Sabbath of Dhamma, living together with Dhamma. And because they think of the Dhamma, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. That's how a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. A corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the Sangha. The Sangha of the Buddha's disciples is practicing the way that's good, direct, methodical, and proper. It consists of the four pairs, the eight individuals. This is the Sangha of the Buddha's disciples that is worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods, worthy of hospitality, worthy of a religious donation, worthy of greeting with joined palms, and is the supreme field of merit for the world. As they recollect the Sangha, their mind becomes clear, joy arises and mental corruptions are given up. It's just like cleaning a dirty cloth by applying effort. And how is a dirty cloth cleaned by applying effort? With salt, lye, cow dung, and water, and by applying the appropriate effort. That's how a dirty cloth is cleaned by applying effort. In the same way, a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the Sangha. The Sangha of the Buddha's disciples is practicing the way that's good, direct, methodical, and proper. It consists of the four pairs, the eight individuals. This Sangha of the Buddha's disciples is worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods, worthy of hospitality, worthy of a religious donation, and worthy of veneration with joined palms. It is the supreme field of merit for the world. As they recollect the Sangha, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. This is called a noble disciple who observes the Sabbath of the Sangha, living together with the Sangha. And because they think of the Sangha, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. That's how a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. A corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects their own ethical conduct, which is unbroken, impeccable, spotless, and unmarred, liberating, praised by sensible people, not mistaken, and leading to immersion. As they recollect their ethical conduct, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. It's just like cleaning a dirty mirror by applying effort. And how is a dirty mirror cleaned by applying effort? With oil, ash, a rolled-up cloth, and by applying the appropriate effort. That's how a dirty mirror is cleaned by applying effort. In the same way, a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects their own ethical conduct, which is unbroken, impeccable, spotless, and unmarred, liberating, praised by sensible people, not mistaken, and leading to immersion. As they recollect their ethical conduct, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. This is called a noble disciple who observes the Sabbath of ethical conduct, living together with ethics. And because they think of their ethical conduct, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. That's how a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. A corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the deities. There are the gods of the four great kings, the gods of the 33, the gods of Yama, the joyful gods, the gods who love to create, the gods who control the creations of others, the gods of Brahma's host, and gods even higher than these. When those deities passed away from here, they were reborn there because of their faith, ethics, learning, generosity, and wisdom. I too have the same kind of faith, ethics, learning, generosity, and wisdom. As they recollect the faith, ethics, learning, generosity, and wisdom of both themselves and those deities, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. It's just like cleaning dirty gold by applying effort. And how is dirty gold cleaned by applying effort? With a furnace, flux, a blowpipe, and tongs, and by applying the appropriate effort, that's how dirty gold is cleaned by applying effort. In the same way, a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. And how is a corrupt mind cleaned by applying effort? It's when a noble disciple recollects the deities. There are the gods of the four great kings, the gods of the 33, the gods of Yama, the joyful gods, the gods who love to create, the gods who control the creations of others, the gods of Brahma's host, and gods even higher than these. When those deities passed away from here, they were reborn there because of their faith, ethics, learning, generosity, and wisdom. I too have the same kind of faith, ethics, learning, generosity, and wisdom. As they recollect the faith, ethics, learning, generosity, and wisdom of both themselves and those deities, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. This is called a noble disciple who observes the Sabbath of the deities, living together with the deities. And because they think of the deities, their mind becomes clear, joy arises, and mental corruptions are given up. That's how a corrupt mind is cleaned by applying effort. Then that noble disciple reflects, as long as they live, the perfected ones give up killing living creatures, renouncing the rod and the sword. They are scrupulous and kind and live full of compassion for all living beings. I too, for this day and night, will give up killing living creatures, renouncing the rod and the sword. I'll be scrupulous and kind and live full of compassion for all living beings. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. As long as they live, the perfected ones give up stealing. They take only what's given and expect only what's given. They keep themselves clean by not thieving. I too, for this day and night, will give up stealing. I'll take only what's given and expect only what's given. I'll keep myself clean by not thieving. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. As long as they live, the perfected ones give up unchastity. They are celibate, set apart, avoiding the common practice of sex. I too, for this day and night, will give up unchastity. I will be celibate, set apart, avoiding the common practice of sex. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. As long as they live, the perfected ones give up lying. They speak the truth and stick to the truth. They're honest and trustworthy and don't trick the world with their words. I too, for this day and night, will give up lying. I'll speak the truth and stick to the truth. I'll be honest and trustworthy and won't trick the world with my words. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. As long as they live, the perfected ones give up alcoholic drinks that cause negligence. I too, for this day and night, will give up alcoholic drinks that cause negligence. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. As long as they live, the perfected ones eat in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and from food at the wrong time. I too, for this day and night, will eat in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and food at the wrong time. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. As long as they live, the perfected ones avoid dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows, and beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, fragrance, and makeup. I too, for this day and night, will avoid dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows, and beautifying and adorning myself with garlands, fragrance, and makeup. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. As long as they live, the perfected ones give up high and luxurious beds. They sleep in a low place, either a cot or a straw mat. I too, for this day and night, will give up high and luxurious beds. I'll sleep in a low place, either a cot or a straw mat. I will observe the Sabbath by doing as the perfected ones do in this respect. That's the Sabbath of the noble ones. When the Sabbath of the noble ones is observed like this, it's very fruitful and beneficial and splendid and bountiful. How much so? Suppose you were to rule as sovereign lord over these 16 great countries, Anga, Magadha, Kasi, Kosala, Wajji, Malla, Chetti, Wanga, Kuru, Panchala, Macha, Surusena, Asaka, Awanti, Gandhara, and Cambodia, full of the seven treasures. This wouldn't be worth a 16th part of the Sabbath with its eight factors. Why is that? Because human kingship is a poor thing compared to the happiness of the gods. 50 years in the human realm is one day and night for the gods of the four great kings. 30 such days make up a month. 12 such months make up a year. The lifespan of the gods of the four great kings is 500 of these divine years. It's possible that a woman or man who has observed the eight-factored Sabbath will, when their body breaks up after death, be reborn in the company of the gods of the four great kings. This is what I was referring to when I said human kingship is a poor thing compared to the happiness of the gods. 100 years in the human realm is one day and night for the gods of the 33. 30 such days make up a month. 12 such months make up a year. The lifespan of the gods of the 33 is 1,000 of these divine years. It's possible that a woman or man who has observed the eight-factored Sabbath will, when their body breaks up after death, be reborn in the company of the gods of the 33. This is what I was referring to when I said human kingship is a poor thing compared to the happiness of the gods. 200 years in the human realm is one day and night for the gods of Yama. 30 such days make up a month. 12 such months make up a year. The lifespan of the gods of Yama is 2,000 of these divine years. It's possible that a woman or man who has observed the eight-factored Sabbath will, when their body breaks up after death, be reborn in the company of the gods of Yama. This is what I was referring to when I said human kingship is a poor thing compared to the happiness of the gods. 400 years in the human realm is one day and night for the joyful gods. 30 such days make up a month. 12 such months make up a year. The lifespan of the joyful gods is 4,000 of these divine years. It's possible that a woman or man who has observed the eight-factored Sabbath will, when their body breaks up after death, be reborn in the company of the joyful gods. This is what I was referring to when I said human kingship is a poor thing compared to the happiness of the gods. 800 years in the human realm is one day and night for the gods who love to create. 30 such days make up a month. 12 such months make up a year. The lifespan of the gods who love to create is 8,000 of these divine years. It's possible that a woman or man who has observed the eight-factored Sabbath will, when their body breaks up after death, be reborn in the company of the gods who love to create. This is what I was referring to when I said human kingship is a poor thing compared to the happiness of the gods. 1,600 years in the human realm is one day and night for the gods who control the creations of others. 30 such days make up a month. 12 such months make up a year. The lifespan of the gods who control the creations of others is 16,000 of these divine years. It's possible that a woman or man who has observed the eight-factored Sabbath will, when their body breaks up after death, be reborn in the company of the gods who control the creations of others. This is what I was referring to when I said human kingship is a poor thing compared to the happiness of the gods. You shouldn't kill living creatures, or steal, or lie, or drink alcohol. Be celibate, refraining from sex, and don't eat at night, the wrong time. Not wearing garlands or applying fragrance, you should sleep on a low bed or a mat on the ground. This is the eight-factored Sabbath, they say, explained by the Buddha, who has gone to suffering's end. The moon and sun are both fair to see, radiating as far as they revolve. Those shining ones in the sky light up the quarters, dispelling the darkness as they traverse the heavens. All of the wealth that's found in this realm, pearls, gems, fine beryl too, horn gold or mountain gold or natural gold dug up by marmots. They're not worth a 16th part of the Sabbath with its eight factors, as starlight cannot rival the moon. So an ethical woman or man who has observed the eight-factored Sabbath, having made merit whose outcome is happiness, blameless, they go to a heavenly place.